Screen Time with John Fardy. This is News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Screen Time. I'm John Fardy and this is News Talk's TV and movie show. This week on the show, the cast of the new Lisa McGee show on Netflix, How to Get to Heaven from Belfast, chat to me about the irreverent show. And the cast include the great Roisin Gallagher. Acclaimed director of Alien Romulus, Fede Alvarez, talks to me about his fascinating career journey, from his YouTube movie made in Uruguay to the mean streets of Hollywood, ahead of his trip to Render in Belfast. And as always, all the week's new movies and TV releases, including the new Sam Raimi movie, Send Help. Plus, we have five pairs of tickets to give away to the screening of the upcoming Amanda Seyfried film, The Testament of Anne Lee. You can email me screentime@newstalk.com. This show is available as a podcast every Friday at 5 p.m. on the Go Loud app or wherever you get your podcasts. And it's on the radio every Saturday at 6 p.m. here on News Talk. Good weekend to you all, and I do hope you're doing well. We are in meteorological spring, by all accounts. Man, it doesn't feel like it. Good heavens. I was doing a race, half marathon, on Sunday morning, and my wife was doing the associated 10K, and we were in the car right before it started. And we weren't a million miles away from turning the car around and going home because it was bucketing down. It really was. How do you know someone's doing a half marathon? Because they tell you. But I'm just telling you to situate the week I had in the rain. But we both finished our respective races. Aren't we amazing? Yes, is the correct answer. Anyway, I hope you are dry, or as dry as you can be in this horrible, horrible weather we've all been subjected to. And hopefully spring will show up soon. There is a bit of blue in the sky. That's from Wuthering Heights, which we'll be talking about next week. We have a full show this week, so why am I even mentioning that? So listen, let's get to TV. And this week I was watching this.
The police, they're on their way. And they sent the first responder, so Ira's with him now.
This is some kind of sick joke.
Danny, what the hell? Sorry. The police would be here.
They're on their way.
They shall.
No. I'm sorry.
We'll go. We'll go.
No, we're not leaving. He'll be back. He'll be hungry. He'll want his dinner.
Shall we go
anyway?
Now.
He'll be back.
Oh, now. Put that down. We've got to go now. Put it down. Put it down. Get
Daddy,
your coat on. Where is he?
Wait for the police. Okay.
Where is he?
He's at William Street in the ditch.
Let's go. Let's go now. You stay here. You watch the boys. You don't say a word to them. All right?
Now that is a clip from Under Salt Marsh, which is on Sky Atlantic on Friday nights, I believe it is. It's also on Now TV. The first two episodes are available now, and they only sent me two. And this is Kelly Riley, who people know from Yellowstone and Rafe's Ball. And Kelly Riley is in this fictional Welsh town, and she discovers the body of a young boy. And it turns out she lost her niece 3 years before that. This is all taking place in this fictional Welsh town that is almost like feels like a Scandinavian kind of town. This drama feels like Scandi noir, like something like The Killing. And she's a school teacher and she's a bit broken from things that have happened to her. And she may have been a policewoman in the past. That's not a spoiler because it's kind of in the trailer. And it's taking place in this community in Wales that is very tightly knit. And it's also getting prepared for a storm and kind of climate change. And it's almost sinking, this town on this marsh. Rafe Spall comes in. He has some history with Kelly Riley. And he goes investigating the disappearance of this child, the murder of this child, and what else might be involved in the locale. It is a great watch so far. Nice and twisty. Brilliant end to the first episode. Pleasingly dark, very Scandi-noirish, albeit in Wales. So Under Salt Marsh on Sky. Great dark thriller that I've been enjoying. Want to mention The Sacred Vows on RTE. Don't always mention the national broadcaster. This is Tom Vaughan Lawler and lots of other people. Tom Vaughan Lawler plays a priest who goes to the wedding of a young woman whose parents invite him because they knew him a long time ago. And he arrives in this villa in Tenerife and a lot of people don't want him there. And he's very awkward around all the wedding guests. And it's a dark comedy because at the very opening shot, he's lying dead in a swimming pool. This isn't getting great reviews. I thought it was pretty okay. I watched the first two episodes and it held my attention. And it seems to move to different characters in the wedding party. And it just reminded me of what a damn fine actor Tom Vaughan Lawler is. I've never not liked him. He was in a thing a couple of years ago called Rialto, about this man living a double life in Rialto, obviously, in Dublin. And it was released kind of around COVID, and it was brilliant. Never got the kudos it deserved, or certainly his performance. He's a brilliant actor, and he's brilliant in this. It's not maybe going to change your life, but based on two episodes, fine piece of Sunday night TV. That's The Sacred Vows on RTE on Sunday nights. Quickly want to mention a movie that was launched last week called Iron Lung. This was made, directed, produced and stars a man called Markiplier. One kind of name. Markiplier. And he is a YouTuber. And he is one of the most famous YouTubers in the world for playing video games online. And he got lots and lots of views. And he's made a movie based on a video game called Iron Lung. And he made it for a tiny budget. And it's made the budget back and then some. And my 13-year-old came to me on Sunday night and said, can we go and see this in the cinema? And he told me all about it. So we went to the cinema on Monday night to watch it. And the guy I loosely know in the cinema up near where I live told me lots of people were coming to see it. So I was so excited about this. And it's about this guy who's a convict who's sent to, in a kind of apocalyptic world, take photographs or maybe kill a beast, seemingly in kind of a submarine-like pod, and there's lots of blood around. I was really excited by this, and I was terribly disappointed, I have to say, because it was just too long and a bit dull. I'm very claustrophobic. Claustrophobic can be fine, but it's largely this guy in a submarine pod seeing scary things on a camera. I salute the ambition and I salute the effort. And it's a miracle any movie gets made. And it's a miracle this movie got made for $3 million. And he's making all his money back. So what does he care that the humble host of Screen Time didn't really like it? But I didn't. I'm saying Iron Lung is a bit dull, but lots of people disagree. But I went to see it in the cinema this week and had a nice time going to the cinema, where I have to say it was about 5 o'clock on the Monday of the bank holiday, a rapt audience, not even a sight of a phone, not even someone loudly munching or anything. It was like a prayer meeting and everyone was, you know, praying to the screen. I was very impressed. I hadn't been in a civilian screening, if I may be so bold, in a while. And you could have heard a pin drop. So even though I wasn't mad about what was on screen, I did enjoy going to the cinema and having such a rapt audience. I do have to tell you about a great competition we have this week. We're giving 5 lucky listeners the chance to win a pair of tickets to the Irish premiere screening in 70mm of Searchlight Pictures' The Testament of Anne Lee. And this screening is going to be on Monday the 16th of February in Dublin. From award-winning writer and director Mona Fastvold comes the extraordinary true legend of Anne Lee, founder of the devotional sect known as the Shakers. The Testament of Anne Lee captures the ecstasy and agony of her quest to build a utopia, featuring more than a dozen traditional Shaker hymns reimagined as rapturous movements. Doesn't that sound interesting? It stars the great Amanda Seyfried, who I think I'm going to be talking to soon on the show. The Testament of Anne Lee is opening in 70mm from the 20th of February and a wider release on the 27th of February. As I say, we're giving away 5 pairs of tickets to a screening in Dublin on the 16th of February. Please only enter if you can attend. 5 pairs of tickets. All you have to do is tell me the answer to this very simple question. Amanda Seyfried, who stars in the movie, was famously in a movie called A, Mean Girls, or B, Bad Boys. It was her breakout role, all about a load of mean girls. So was it A, Mean Girls, or B, Bad Boys? Text the word movie, your answer and your name to 53106. That's 53106. Text cost 30 cents. It is a text competition. You have to text the word movie, your answer and your name to 53106. If you're listening on podcast, the lines will stay open till Monday evening. So enter and maybe you'll be one of the lucky 5 winners. And now we turn to the week's new cinema releases, and chief among them is the new Sam Raimi directed movie Send Help. Sam Raimi, of course, gave us the Evil Dead trilogy, everything, A Simple Plan, even some Spider-Man movies. It's a kind of this one, as far as I gather, has Rachel McAdams and Dylan O'Brien as kind of sole survivors on a desert island or something like that. Delighted to be joined now by Ken Doran, who has seen it and is here to tell me more. Hi, Ken. How are you?
I'm good, John. How are you?
Very well. So this is Rachel McAdams and Dylan O'Brien stranded on a desert island.
Yes, that makes up the bulk of the movie. We kind of begin, we get a sense of who these characters are. So Rachel McAdams, as you said, is in this, and she's playing this kind of put upon woman. She's, you know, in her professional life, it's keep the head down, stay the course, and eventually it'll all pay off. And Dylan O'Brien is this kind of, his father ran the company that they're in, like a Fortune 500 company, who by all accounts seems to be a fair man, the father, but the son comes in, he's a bit spoiled, kind of wants to put his friends into the top position. So we get a sense of the culture and the relationships at the start, which I think is important for where we go, because as you say, the bulk of the film takes place on this island. The only reason Rachel McAdams' character was even on the plane that crashed to get them on the island was they were on the way to do this kind of big merger, and they wanted to use her to do the grunt work, essentially, so that all, you know, the lads could go off on the golf course. So in the beginning, it's actually quite sad and quite heartbreaking and does a lot to develop your sympathy for Rachel McAdams' character. But once we get to the island, this is where she really comes into her own. She begins to flourish because it's kind of set up that she is really into survival and, you know, going out on hikes and camping and making fires and shelters and stuff. So really, this is, you know, her inner element.
And so just in terms of getting from corporate America to the island, though, she's en route to this business trip as his kind of gopher of sorts, and there's a plane crash and they land on an island.
Essentially, we kind of, the film doesn't spend too much time on that. It's more of a quick setup, and then for some unexplained reason, the plane has a malfunction. They crash in the ocean, and the only two survivors are Rachel McAdams' character and Dylan O'Brien's character. And it's interesting, I suppose, because as I say, we spend the majority of the film here, and what really happens is we kind of go back and forth in terms of the characters' dynamics, you know. So in corporate America, Dylan O'Brien was the boss, he was the one in charge, whereas here he's really dependent on Rachel McAdams' character to survive. And I think a lot of the sympathy that we established at the start goes a long way to maybe giving us as an audience a bit more latitude to some of the things that go on the island, because, you know, probably not giving away too much to say the power might go to her head a tiny bit, you know, in this situation.
Right. Now, in the, I haven't seen this, but in the trailer and even the poster, she's got a knife in her hand. She's kind of bloodied. There's a touch of almost Apocalypse Now about it. I presume it gets kind of brutal and maybe even horror-ish or not.
Yeah, well, this, as you said, this is a Sam Raimi movie, and going into this, you can expect that kind of, you know, touches from him. Some people have compared this to Castaway. I'd say it's a little bit more like Lord of the Flies.
Okay.
And there's elements of Misery as well, the Stephen King story. So we have elements of horror, elements of kind of gore. You know, obviously they're surviving on an island. There's, you know, scenes where they have to go hunt for food. But as I say, the time spent on the island and the dynamic between the characters, it's dynamic in every sense, because there's ups and there's downs. There's, you know, moments where there seems like there's romantic tension. Then there's times where it seems like they want to kill each other. So we really kind of spend the bulk of the time with them in that kind of state.
And without giving any spoilers, they're on an island and they have this power play going on, but I presume they encounter other things on this island.
Yeah, in a way, they I suppose without giving too much away, little things crop up that kind of, just when you think the status quo has been established, something will happen that kind of throws it all, you know, out the window.
And I'm getting a sense there's a good few twists.
Yes, there's a lot of twists, and that's the thing. You can, you know, I can't say too much.
No,
but it's you know, I think it would be fair to say that in terms of a film, and I know it sounds silly to say, but as a film, there's no fat left on this. You know, there's nothing that doesn't need to be there, because from where we begin and where we end and everything in between, it all kind of adds up to how you're going to come away feeling at the end of this movie.
Okay, so does it all add up to a good watch?
I really liked it. And, okay, you know, it was quite interesting. When I was leaving the cinema, there was a couple of, you know, people ahead of me chatting about it. And one asked his friend, what did he think about it? And he said, oh, you know, I'm not sure. Like, it was good, but the last 20 minutes kind of came off the rails. But I thought the last part of the movie, the kind of third act, was probably the most interesting one, you know. And part of that is by virtue of it's the kind of the rising tension and everything that has been set up is coming to a head. But it also felt like the most Sam Raimi portion of the movie, which, as you said in your intro, Sam Raimi, people know him from The Evil Dead, but more lately, you know, things like Spider-Man, or he did the Doctor Strange movies, which I think it's fair to say these kind of movies, they're movies in a particular genre that feel like, you know, oh, that little bit felt like a Sam Raimi movie, whereas this felt like a back to basics. This felt like much more pared back, and kind of like an Evil Dead, where you have one or two characters stuck in a location facing, you know, kind of challenges from within and without. You know, this felt like a, you know, an art piece that had his fingerprints all over it.
Okay, so we'll keep the Sam Raimi enthusiasts happy, it seems. And tell me this, is there a kind of metaphor here for, you know, gender politics and corporate America, or corporate America in general?
Yes, I suppose. It's interesting. I suppose there's themes. So Rachel McAdams' character, she's the survivalist, and she kind of has this, you know, idea that a positive attitude is the best tool you can have with you. And she kind of alludes to that remaining positive and being positive. And that kind of reflects how she was in her, you know, in her corporate life, that, you know, if she keeps her head down, stays positive, good things will happen. But in terms of how the movie plays out, it's actually quite maybe pessimistic, you know, and kind of maybe, I kind of came away with it that the message of the movie is, if, you know, you want something, you kind of have to take it, and maybe the kind of ruthlessness is what's going to reward you in the long run.
Okay. This sounds pretty decent, I have to say. So what would you say stars-wise for Send Help, which is in cinemas from this Friday, 6th of February?
I'd give it 4 stars.
Okay. Excellent. And people who like things like Darkman and The Evil Dead, some of Raimi's best, will probably be pleased with this then.
I think so. I think, as I said, it kind of captures a lot of his things, like the horror elements, the kind of gore, but also if you're, you know, a fan of like Army of Darkness and stuff, there's an element of kind of silliness or a bit of fun to it as well.
Okay, this sounds great. So that is 4 stars for Send Help, courtesy of Ken Doran. And Ken, thanks a million.
Thank you.
Howdy.
Oh, howdy.
What'd I miss out here?
It's not a whole lot. Where have you been?
Exploring. Found a new water source.
Great. Oh, got a iced frapp there?
So much cleaner, so delicious. Give it a try.
Love the backpack. You make that today?
Yeah, what do you think? Yeah, isn't that cute?
Super cute.
Okay, what's the matter?
What do you think is the matter? We've been here, what? 2 weeks now? How have they not found us yet?
I don't know. I mean, I'm sure it'll be soon. Anyway, you know what the most important thing is for human survival? The number one thing. Positive attitude.
A clip there from Send Help, which Ken Doran gave 4 stars to. Up next, the cast of the new Lisa McGee Netflix drama, How to Get to Heaven from Belfast. Now you're welcome back to Screen Time, News Talk's TV and movie show. Now, clever, chaotic TV writer Saoirse, glamorous, stressed out mother of three Robin, and dependable, inhibited carer Dara have been a tight knit of close friends since school, now in their late 30s, but still as close as ever. These three females are about to embark on one of the most thrilling adventures of their lives when an email arrives telling them about the death of their estranged fourth member of their childhood gang. A series of eerie events at her wake, set in train, a dark and dangerous and sometimes hilarious odyssey through Ireland, largely in Donegal and beyond, as each tries to piece together the truth of their past. It's a show about friendship, memory, and what happens when life doesn't quite pan out the way you thought it might, which sees much of the action, as I say, take place in a beautiful looking Donegal. And the lady stay in a hotel that is fronted by or manned by Ardal O'Hanlon wearing a very strange dickie bow. I should mention this is the latest comedy drama from the great Lisa McGee, the writer of Derry Girls. Roisin Gallagher, who we raved about in The Dry and The Lovers, stars as Saoirse. Sinead Keenan, who many people will know from Unforgettable, plays Robin. And Keelan Dunn, it was because of the first name, Keelan Dunn, who we know from things like Andor and of course a small show called Love Hate, plays Dara. And I'm delighted to say they're in the studio, corporeal form, on the shittiest day of the year imaginable. Guys, hello, how are you?
Good, thank you.
Hello.
Listen, Christoph Waltz walked out of an interview once because someone said, describe the show for me, but in terms of what I said there, I'll start with you, Sinead, is that kind of accurate or is there anything else I kind of missed in terms of its description?
That sounds fairly bang on. At the heart of it, essentially, is three friends. They met at secondary school. They go back to Donegal. They find out that a friend of theirs from school had died, and they're going to go and pay their respects. And then when they get to the wake, they realise that perhaps the body in the coffin isn't hers.
And we're allowed to say that, aren't we? By the way, I've watched five of these, so I've watched five of them. Yeah.
Right. So yes. No, I think we can say, because that happens in the first. Mm-hmm. We will.
Yeah.
I think we release it in the trailer, don't we? It's in the...
That's true. Yeah. So no spoilers.
No spoilers. And then in terms of, you know, it's a drama comedy, but it's very funny with no surprise. But it's... these people are stressed out in their lives. Was that one of the appeals maybe that, you know, you get to a certain point in life and maybe it hasn't worked out quite the way you thought it might?
In terms of my own life.
In terms of the characters. No.
What are you saying?
You're doing fine.
I was doing okay.
Oh my God.
No, the appeal essentially was, it was Lisa McGee.
Okay.
And another brilliant script. And that was it really. And the fact, you know, that it's got three central, really good, well-defined, characters at the heart of it was the appeal.
Yeah.
And any chance to get back to work in Belfast, then, you know,
yeah,
I'd be delighted to take it, you know.
Roisin, Lisa McGee was mentioned there. It seems to me that she's like, you can't say Woody Allen anymore, but there was a time when Woody Allen called and you answered his call. Lisa McGee's probably like that for Irish and English actresses at the moment. I mean, I read something about you heard it was happening and kind of said, please let me get involved in this somehow. Is that accurate?
It is. It is. That is one of the things that would be accurate. Absolutely true. Just heard sort of the jungle drums were going, that she was writing something else, and she was writing it about Belfast and it was going to be female led. And I kind of rang my agent and was like, is there any chance, do you think, that I could get it on here? So yeah, when the script came through and I was able to have a read of it and put myself on tape and go through the process of that, you know, that really, really very complicated, complex kind of process of casting something like this, because
yeah,
it's ensemble and getting the right people. And yeah, just delighted to have been considered and a part of that, you know.
Your character is a BAFTA nominated writer of a very famous of a show in the series.
Mm-hmm.
She's very stressed as well. They're all kind of stressed to some level in their lives. Is that part of the appeal? I know I keep coming back to stressed, and I don't mean in your own life, but the idea of people getting to a point in their life thinking they've loads of success, but it's still really complicated.
I love it. I that's one of the things that just made me laugh so much, that she... Well, the first scene I read is when we first meet Saoirse, when the audience first meets her, and she's at a really, really annoying meeting in this posh restaurant, and she just wants to have a straight conversation. And, you know, people just aren't really doing what she wants them to do.
Yeah.
And this is very, very annoying.
It's very annoying, isn't it?
Very funny as well. Like, the I think it shows the sort of expectation how stretched we are in, I guess, you know, like in society today on a bit of a macro level. It kind of shows this like you can have it all sort of a thing, but underneath the underneath that, what's going on really?
Yeah.
Like, there's a bit of that.
Keelan, sorry it took so long to get to you.
Quite all right.
You're brilliant in this, and I know it was you straight away, which I think is always a good sign. And, and my wife was watching with me, said, "That's your woman," and went all through all your credits. I said, "Are you sure? Are you sure?" And then we watched, and it definitely was you. But this is a story about friendship.
Yeah.
And Roisin mentioned how hard it can be casting an ensemble. You get on great, and you annoy the SH1T out of each other as well. I wonder, you know, you hear about chemistry tests nowadays. Did you guys hang out at all before this, or was it just, here we go, we better do this?
No, we all auditioned and then were called in to London of a weekend to do a chemistry read in a room with Lisa and Liz Lewin and Carla Strong and Michael. Michael was there, wasn't he?
Yeah.
He was.
Yeah.
To just so they could have a feel of, and I and Lisa said, like, the minute we sat down, she was like, "Yeah, no, that's them."
Yeah.
It's a credit to her, the way she's written these women, that everything's on the page. That friendship is there.
Yeah.
And I think we all know these people, whether we're friends with them ourselves or we've just met them in passing in our lives.
Yeah.
I think there's also something about working at home. You just kind of relax into stuff a bit more. And we all, there's a cultural similarity between everybody. You don't have to explain jokes to people. You don't have to explain your ways to people. Everybody, there's an ease in working with people who, you know, grew up in the same city as you, like me and Sinead, or, you know.
Well, I was going to say, I know people like me get obsessed with accents and people who do good ones and people who do bad ones, but I'm a dub like you.
Yeah.
But you sound right on the money here. Was that just natural? Was there a dialect coach?
No, that was just listen and repeat. But I'd done a Belfast accent before in industry.
Yeah.
So I'd had practice at it. But you're there and you're immersed in it. So it makes it just that little bit easier. But again, it's just practice, practice, practice. And the occasional question to Roisin of, is this, what kind of, is this right? Does this sound weird? But then after a while, it just becomes the character's voice, and you're not in your head as much about it. But at the same time, you want to do right by the people that you're there to play. You know, you don't want to be going up and making a mess of it and people being like, "Well, could we not have just got somebody local then instead of you? Why did we get ship you in here?" So you really want to do right by the people of Belfast and get it right.
Yeah, well, you certainly did that as well. Are we allowed to say, Sinead, that we see you in the Late Late Show audience at one point?
Well, I think we just
have. Was that a fun thing to do? Because that's an iconic show for people like you and me, and maybe for Roisin as well.
It is. No, that was great fun. Obviously, that was always the, you know, growing up in Dublin, that was always the
Gabo and
viewing. Oh, yeah. One for everyone in the audience. But yeah, that was great fun. We'd obviously, Patrick Keelty, it was a bit odd.
Do tell.
No, just being in the audience, like, just being in the audience of the Late Late.
Yeah.
That wasn't the Late Late.
That wasn't the Late Late. Just mad.
Yeah.
But good fun.
Roisin, I mentioned before you came on, I loved The Dry and The Lovers. Brilliant shows, hilarious shows, and you're great in them. And here we are, you know, a year down the road, and we're talking about another homegrown Irish comedy drama. We keep hearing about the boom time for TV and film in Ireland, but this seems to bear true to that, and you're constantly showing up in Irish and Northern Irish and whatever it's called, Irish drama. Is it a boom time, do you think? I know I'm putting words in your mouth there, and it'd be hard to disagree with me.
Well, no, I don't disagree with you at all. I think it certainly is a boom time for me in terms of my career and the incredible writers that I've worked with over the last few years. Has it always been around? Have we always been able to tell stories? Absolutely.
Yeah.
Has it always been, have we always had the platform to do it on? Maybe not so much. So for me, it's not that we have changed so much, but it's just that the world has opened up a little bit more. Everything's got smaller in terms of, like, we can, you know, it's more accessible and the platforms that we watch things on. And I know I love celebrating the success of our of where we're from and the stories that we want to tell. And I think that's one of the lovely things about being in Belfast as well, is you feel, I feel very well supported.
Yeah.
Like, people are just really proud, you know, of people who go on to kind of tell the stories in a global kind of capacity, which is that this is what this is going to be for Netflix.
Yeah.
It's new for me, you know, so fingers crossed.
And I hate to bring up accents again, but it occurs to me you're really keeping yours. And I mean that as a compliment. Is that just natural, or do you kind of sit at home and say, I'm going to make sure I continue to sound this? Because you do bump into people who sound a lot different than they did when they started out.
Yeah, I think when I was away, I went to Scotland for drama school, and I remember coming home, I think maybe the first term, and one of my sisters I'll not repeat exactly what she said, but it was something along the lines of, do you want to say that again in your own voice? And it was a bit like that thing, you know, when you come back and they're like, oh, lovely, who are you dressed up as today? Can you leave the hat at the door? There was a wee bit of that, which is brilliant, and I'm very grateful for it. And there's also just a bit of, this is just the way I live in Belfast. I have, you know, I'm choosing to live there and bring up my family there, and this is just my voice and the way I talk. So,
well, long may it last.
Yeah,
Keelan, I know everyone talks about love hate, but I'm not going to. You'd be pleased to hear. But as one of those kids who was taken to the Empire Strikes Back when he was six or something like that, and will never forget it, just being on a Star Wars set for Andor, for people who don't know, it must be a very strange trip to be part of that machine.
That was that's a bucket list item for me. And the gift of that show, because it's an incredibly written piece of drama. It really is. In that universe, to take that genre of thriller, spy thriller, and put it in that universe, it was amazing. And putting on that costume even, and standing there and seeing myself and being like, well, the Empire is not exactly the side I saw myself on, but I will take it.
That's right, you were a baddie, of course.
I was a baddie. Yeah. Yeah, it was magic. It really is. I get to hold it over my brother for the rest of my life. No matter what he does, I'll be like, yes, that's wonderful, Doctor. But I was in Star Wars.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Take your PhD. I have a lightsaber. Fantastic. I should mention, that's a Disney production. We are here talking about the Netflix one.
Netflix.
How to Get to Heaven from Belfast. And finally, Roisin, I mentioned on the way in The Dry. I love that. I spoke to Paddy Branock about it. And great show. I wonder, did you find this was a woman successfully staying off alcohol? But it's a tricky thing to do. I wonder, did you find people kind of in quiet moments said, you know, I found that? Or like, did you notice that the sober community might have embraced that? Because I heard one or two people mention that.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. There was a lot of contact actually being made about people, not just of their own journey, whether it was sober curious or they were in a program or they, you know, or they just never drunk or didn't drink. But a lot of the conversations that brought about was about the family dynamic and how those things are talked about currently within a large sort of typically Irish family, culturally what it's like. And I think one of the first responses was, and really this is testament to Nancy Harris, but it was like, thank you, because it articulated something that I wasn't able to help my family understand. Mm. And watching The Dry with my family helped us be able to have a conversation about something that otherwise we didn't know how to talk about.
Right.
So that's kind of cool.
Absolutely it is. What's also cool is the new Netflix show, How to Get to Heaven from Belfast. 6 of the 8 episodes, or was it 5? I can't remember. Maybe I'm lying. I'm not. It was 5 episodes I've seen. It's going to be out on the 12th of February. Lisa McGee has done it again, it's fair to say. I've been in studio with its 3 leads, Roisin Gallagher, Sinead Keenan and Keelan Dunn. Guys, thanks a million for coming in.
Thank you.
Dear Saoirse, Dara and Robin, I have some terribly sad news.
1 second, my friend is dead. My friend is dead. We're dying now.
Nightmare, isn't it?
The whole thing's just awful.
She was so young.
I was talking about your outfit. Are they pyjamas?
They're trousers.
They look like pyjamas.
Robin. Why contact us in the first place? It's been 20 years.
A clip there from How to Get to Heaven from Belfast, which will be on Netflix from next week. And you heard me talking to its 3 leads there, Roisin Gallagher, Caoimhín Dunn and Sinead Keenan, three brilliant Irish actresses. Up next, a brilliant film director, Fede Alvarez, the man who gave us Alien Romulus and Evil Dead. Now you're listening to Screen Time News Talks TV and Movie Show. Now, taking place next week in Belfast is Render, a two-day creative industries festival that focuses on film, TV, animation, and all sorts of immersive industries. Over the course of two evenings in February, the event will host sessions with creators behind franchises like K-Pop Demon, Stranger Things, and even The Last of Us. However, one of the standouts is one of the people talking is Uruguayan filmmaker Fede Alvarez, the writer and director of Alien Romulus, as well as directing the most recent, 2013, Evil Dead, and the brilliant horror from 2016, Don't Breathe. And I'm delighted to say he joins me all the way from Los Angeles now. Fede, hello, how are you?
Hey, how you doing, John?
I'm very well, and I hope the sun is shining in Los Angeles, where you're talking to me from today.
Yes.
Let me ask you this, you know, part of your story, if people care to read about it, and I'm wondering how true this is, or is it sometimes exaggerated for journalistic purposes, but your short movie, which translates as Panic Attack, is uploaded to YouTube, and literally overnight it goes huge and your inbox is flooded with emails. Is that exaggerated, or is that more or less how you remember it happening?
That is exactly how it happened. And it's still rare. At the time, it was rare, still rare. But it was exactly like that. We made a short movie with $300 back in Uruguay. We're still living there with some friends. And it was very ambitious. It was a kind of science fiction short with giant robots, like mecha anime-style robots destroying my city, but done in a almost documentary way, like just with handheld cameras running around the city, like documenting the moment. And I at that time, you have to remember that YouTube was 4 years old. So this is late 2009, December 2009. And we just put it on YouTube because it was the easiest way to send, you know, my mother a link, I guess, you know, to send someone a link to see it instead of send a massive file to someone as you used to do.
Yeah.
So we put it online, we sent it away, and I went to bed. And during those hours, by the time I woke up, I had 150 emails on my mailbox. I was all Hollywood. The studios, the agents, the lawyers trying to sign you, like everybody. It was quite crazy. And they flew me to LA. And by Monday, I was having my first movie deal to make a film that eventually turned into Evil Dead. So it's pretty crazy the way it happened. But that's exactly how it happened. I would have never, as a Uruguayan, being the first one in to work here in this industry, at that level, it had never happened in the history of the country. So you never think you're going to be the one that's going to do it. So it's actually a good thing. I think we do the work just for the the goal is to do the work, is to tell that story and nothing else. It was never ambitions of getting nowhere or like getting higher or getting paid to do it. So I think that was our heart was in the right place, and we did it for that reason. And then all that came and it was kind of a complete surprise.
Yeah, and there's a great lesson in that. Make something you care about, and maybe the other stuff might take care of itself, or the emails might come. Tell me this. As it happens, I went to see a movie last night that my 13-year-old son wanted me to go to, called Iron Lung, and it was by a YouTuber.
Yeah.
And it's funny, on this show last week, I was talking to a YouTube producer, and she was imagining a moment in the future where movies would be made specifically for YouTube. So I'm thinking of Iron Lung, and I'm thinking of you as well. So you put this movie on YouTube. This other guy makes his movie Iron Lung and hopes to get it into a cinema. And you hope to get your movies into cinema back in 2009. So would you ever consider making a movie for YouTube? Or is it always, I can't wait, that people will watch this in the dark in a crowded movie theater? And I don't want to put words in your mouth.
I think it depends on the story you're telling. I think there's certain movies for me, and I'm 47 years old, I'm a different generation, and I feel like certain stories should be told, should be seen on a big screen. You know, that's how I like to see them, like with a big crowd, feeding off their reactions. You know, it doesn't work if the theater is empty, but if it's full, you know, I think that's when this movie works the best. You know, a lot of movies, any movie, I think, to hear the gasps and like being together, having that experience, I think is the way to experience them. But look, you know, with the example of Panic Attack, that short movie was perfect for YouTube. It was like 5 minutes long, you know, like, It will grab you right away in the first few seconds. That wouldn't allow you to just skip to something else. It was perfectly made for that. And I think these days, I mean, obviously people are already making them. You know, it's not YouTube per se, but it's Netflix, YouTube, it's all the same. It's just you know, streaming platforms that you have at home, and people definitely are making them directly for streaming. For me, it's been something I've been purposefully avoiding making movies for streamers. I haven't. The time will come, I'm sure, but I made all my movies for theaters. And it's like I always say, it's like to make a movie for a streamer, for me, it's like if I was a musician and you tell me I'm going to record this album, it's going to be great, you're going to have all the best musicians, you're going to have everything, but the catch is that you can never play it live. That would kill me, right? And no musician will ever accept that deal, right?
Sure.
So for me, the making the movies, the best part is to sit down with an audience and watch it, and be able to then go to another city and another theater and watch it with them as well, and go enjoy that while the movie's in theaters, right? So the streaming thing, the empty, you know, the echoless, you know, moment of finishing the movie and just go home and see online that everybody's watching it and that's it. Like that's, I can't, at the moment, it's not something I'm like, oh, I can wait today.
Yeah.
But I will, I know I will one day, you know, you know, we all do.
Yeah. So listen, you have been given the keys to the kingdom twice in the form of two incredibly successful franchises, Evil Dead and then Alien. And I wonder, you know, sometimes when I was having a look about you earlier, there was all these comments about, let him do this next. He's so good at revitalizing franchise that people previously loved. Is it a particular skill to be able to take something that people love, give it a new twist, and yet keep the old fans still in the tent? It must be.
I think it is. And in my, you know, I think my experience, it's mostly has been that I spend most of my life being an audience member. Mm-hmm. And although I was making short movies and I'm directing since I'm seven, like back home in Uruguay, it was my head was never in Hollywood or trying to make movies here. I never aimed for that, and I never thought it was ever going to happen. But I was just really watching movies, and like most of the movie lovers, we just watch these movies. Sometimes we love them and sometimes we don't, and we get so mad at why they're not doing this, why not doing that, you know. And so I was that guy with my friends being in the theater watching sometimes franchises being taken the wrong direction and making creative turns. They go, why are you doing this thing? Why are you doing that? And the answer to that, I understand that a lot of times it's because the same filmmakers that created the originals, they don't want to do the same thing again.
Yeah.
So they're just starting to move to new directions, want to explore new things. But sometimes they don't give the audience what they want. So when I got here with Evil Dead, the exercise was quite simple for me. It was like, I know what I want as an audience. I'm going to make the movie that I want to see. And I have a kind of a good emotional memory, I guess, of what did I experience when I watched that movie originally. So I felt like sometimes I can be more objective about what did that movie deliver to that audience at that time that was so special. And that's the equation, that's the math that I do in my head, in a way, like, why should I do now to get a similar reaction that movie got originally? And it's never about remaking it, like, you know, not Evil Dead or Alien Romans were remakes. There were always different characters,
sure,
different story, but obviously the same sandbox, and we expect to feel certain emotions, right? As soon as you see the trailer for any of those movies, there's a promise that you better deliver when people go to the theater. So I think that's always been my thing. I spend more time being an audience than a filmmaker, so I guess like I have a good grip on what at least the audience of my generation knows. You know, the younger audience always harder to know what did they want, what did I want to see. But at least for me to make movies for myself, I always came easy to know, you know, what's the kind of Evil Dead movie that I want to see if there was a new one tomorrow. And
yeah.
what's a new alien? If there was a new alien, what's the alien I want to see?
So and you that's approach what I do. It I as a fan.
Yeah.
Terrific. Tell me this. I spoke to Ridley Scott a couple of years ago for his movie, The Last Duel, and he gave me one of the best answers I've ever gotten in an interview. I said to him, why did you make it in Ireland? Because he filmed a lot of it in Ireland. And he said, without blinking an eye, because the tax was cheaper. And I nearly lost the interview because I couldn't stop laughing. But he strikes me as a brilliantly straight-talking kind of guy. In a world of, as you're more aware of I am, there can be a lot of bullshit. I gather with Alien, he kind of stayed out of your way and pretty much said, it's your baby now.
Oh yeah, he did. He did. He was very supportive from the beginning when I basically pitched him what I wanted to do with it. And he was like, that's great. You go ahead, do it. Then I wrote the script with Rosa, I guess, my co-writer in all my movies. And we showed him the script and he was like, great, go make it. And just we made it. Then he watched the cut and he was great. You made a great movie, you know. And then I think towards the very end, when it was about to be closed and shipped and, you know, and signed, sealed, delivered, like at that point, maybe he started saying, I think I have a few thoughts. And he had a lot more thoughts. I think he always waits till the end. That's kind of his strategy as a producer.
Okay.
You're more pressed to actually get it done, or like, and also it's a better moment to really judge if those notes make sense or not, if you need to address them or not. And he always defers to director. With me, he was like, these are my thoughts, but it's always up to you. It's your movie. I mean, he's a director. He knows that a director, the last thing he wants is anybody else imposing notes or tell them where and what direction to take the movie, right? So, but he had a lot of very, very smart thoughts, and I learned so much working with him, you know, in so many levels. And a lot of that, he has a completely different attitude that most people in Hollywood have. Like you had in that interview, he would just, you know, he would just say exactly the truth and how it is, and that's it, and never think on anything what he should say. Right?
Tell me this. I loved your film Don't Breathe. And we live in, I keep hearing about this idea of elevated horror. And I'm not sure I even know what it is, even though I do know what it is on one level. But it seemed to me Don't Breathe was just a great story. And for people who don't know, it's this gang of hoodlums who decide to rob a blind Iraq war veteran. And I won't say any more than that because it goes in fascinating ways. But I think a movie like that, you know, all sorts of things are written about it, but at source, it's just a great old-fashioned story in some way. But you tell me why you think people liked it so much.
I don't know. I mean, it was different. It was familiar, but different, which I think is always kind of, you know, what works best, like in Hollywood, like the things that come and that you think you know what it is, and they invite you to the movie with a trailer or something that makes you feel like you kind of, you know, I kind of get it. I kind of imagine what to expect, but then the movie will take you on uncharted waters very quickly, and you'll have you realize you've never seen anything like it, and you have no idea where it's going. So that I think is what everybody, and today is still the same. We're all desperate to have that experience, to go to a movie theater, sit down thinking, I know the kind of movie I'm going to watch. You know, otherwise people don't go, right? People are very reluctant to go to have to spend the money and have no idea what they're going to see. So you have to give them some framing that makes them understand, okay, I think I know the basics of this. And then be free to just switch gears and make sharp turns that take the story in a completely new way. And that I think is what it was. And also it was really, you know, like I tried in all my movies, I try to push it to the edge of what the genre allows and make sure that there's a moment in the movie, which I love to see, you know, when I was growing up watching, R-rated stuff, you always want to get to a moment that there's something unfolding in front of you that you go, what is this okay? Are we as a society? Movies can movies do this now? Right. And it's exciting. You look around, you're in the theater, everybody's uncomfortable. This movie is like scared, thrill, terrified. Like there gotta be moments like that in movies, particularly in this sort of movies that make you get out of, you know, you come out of the theater and then even if you love the movie, if you didn't love it, it's going to stay with you. And you're going to tell your friends, like, I just seen this movie. And there's a scene in it. Oh, man, do you want me to spoil it for you? And most people go like, no, don't spoil it. I want to go witness that. and that, I think, is something that you know, the hard R-rated movies, anything that is supposed to be more for adults, which, I mean, it's the movies that as a teenager and, you know, you love to see.
Yeah.
They need to deliver on that front. I think Don't Breathe did that. And
it certainly did.
It has a great character. Stephen Lang created a great character. Everybody did a great job in that film. And, you know, sometimes everything comes together and it's great when it works.
Yeah, well, it certainly worked on Don't Breathe. Listen, I'm going to ask you about this event in Belfast, but just en route to that, I'm just curious. You know, I was watching the Grammys a couple of nights ago, and there was a lot of people talking about being migrants, winning these awards, and yet being, you know, the child of an immigrant or themselves an immigrant. You're Uruguayan, living in Los Angeles, and, you know, it seems to me, I know you're not a politician, but there's two different Americas. We hear about America in the headlines, and then we hear about places like New York and Los Angeles, and it just seems to be full of people protesting. How do you feel as someone from South America living in Los Angeles? Here we are in early 2026. What's the mood on the ground there for you?
I mean, it is at the moment, it's quite bleak. Obviously, with everything that's happened with ICE, it's bad, and it's worse than what's on TV. I tell you, like a close friend of mine, like she was now at home with two babies that are not hers. And she's American, right? But she had a babysitter friend that was babysitting the two babies, like they're like, I don't know, 6 months old babies, like twins.
Okay.
And the mother got snatched by ICE, and she was babysitting at home. The mother never came back, and now she had these two babies and nothing to do. So they give it to our friend, and now our friend doesn't know what to do. And imagine, that's just one story of how many that are happening. Imagine how traumatic. I just think of that poor mother somewhere in detention right now, desperately want to know about where her babies are. And it's just stuff like that is happening everywhere and soul crushing. But for me personally, I tell you, it's all kind of a flashback because I'm Uruguayan. So I was born in a dictatorship. Well, I was born in 1978 in the middle of dictatorship in Uruguay. So I still remember very vividly everything that my parents were afraid of and what they were discussing and what's happening in the news and all that stuff that I thought, you know, in the late 80s when democracy came back and the country moved ahead. And then one day you moved to America, I felt like I was left behind, you know, those sort of things were left behind to never be seen again. And then when the first, images of people in like unmarked cars with masks come out of a car and can snatch someone. That was the dictatorship. That was those methods that the dictatorship used in Latin America in those brutal dictatorships of the 60s and 70s. And to suddenly see it in TV here in the United States, I couldn't believe it. It was like it's a whole bit of a flashback. And a lot of things that people are talking about now, like they're shocked about that is happening. I'm like, yeah. I know that was my childhood, you know, we saw it happen over and over. So it's pretty bleak. It's terrible. And I'm a hopeful person. And I think those things cannot sustain themselves. And I hope, you know, everything regains some balance soon.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, let's hope so. To happier news. And then finally, as I mentioned, you're going to be part of this Render event taking place in Belfast next week on the 12th and the 13th. Is that part of kind of the journey now that you get a certain point of success and you think, you know what, maybe I have some stories to tell that, you know, people 30 years younger than me or maybe older might benefit from?
Oh, yeah. I don't do it often. I've been entering a phase, yes, in my life would just be more to start saying yes to some of these invitations that normally I wouldn't say no. It gets me to know places, to know filmmakers in other countries. And I realized that, yes, that the story the story of the short, and particularly there's not a lot of I never want to give myself too much credit, but there is Hollywood, even a lot of my colleagues here, they somehow were already connected. Someone in the family worked in Hollywood. There's not a lot of those stories of the guy that came down from the bus with a backpack and managed to make a career, you know. There's not a lot of that. Or they just come very wealthy families. That happens a lot. My mom would stay at home. My dad was a teacher. Like, that's none of that in Uruguay. And so there's something about those stories. I think that the greater the gap between where you started and where you are when you're a young filmmaker, and the further you get in the story, it always inspires and it always makes people think, I can do this. And it certainly did that for me, right? I remember many moments in my youth and in my teenage years and early 20s when I was dreaming about making movies. All it took was to sometimes hear someone tell me their story. Yeah. And usually the people that worked, they were established and they tell the story. And I realized, this guy was once just like me. He's just like someone that was trying to figure it out, how to make movies, and had a bunch of stories to tell. And so I there's a lot of power in that. And I enjoy talking to an audience and I enjoy sharing the story. I rarely do it. I don't even give much interviews. I mean, this is the first time I talk with the press since we finished the Romulus, the Oscar campaign for Romulus. We got nominated for VFX. So
yeah.
But that, so I don't, but I realize it's good for something. If it helps one guy in the audience and that guy goes on to make a movie, it was worth the whole thing.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, I'm very grateful for you coming out of hibernation to talk to me.
Yeah.
Audiences are in for a treat because you have some stories to tell, and you're going to be speaking at Render in Belfast from the 12th and the 13th of February. That's next week. I've been talking to Fede Alvarez, the acclaimed director of things like Alien, Romulus, Evil Dead, and the brilliant Don't Breed. Fede, I could talk to you all day, but your day is only beginning. Mine is ending, so I better let you go and just thank you very much.
Thank you so much, John. That was a pleasure.
Fede Alvarez there, talking to him about his long and fascinating career. And as you heard there, he will be talking in Belfast next week at the Render Festival. That's it for this week. I'll just remind you, this show is available as a podcast every Friday at 5 p.m. on the Go Loud app or wherever you get your podcasts. And of course, it's on the radio every Saturday at 6 p.m. here on News Talk. Thank you for listening. Enjoy the remainder of your weekend, and I will talk to you all next week.